Chapter 17. Her alias is Maggie Hoyle. From what little I saw of Conrad Hoyle, I'm expecting Maggie to be a mini-militant in training. Instead, she is the polar opposite of her Sepan. Maggie can't be more than 12 years old, and she's small for her age, mousy, with a mane of reddish-brown curls hanging on either side of a pair of thick glasses. The only sign of Hoyle's influence is the small handgun she's holding when I walk in, the kind of polite-looking weapon a rich lady might carry with her in a bad neighborhood. Maggie looks relieved to set the gun down as soon as the door is locked behind me.
"Is Conrad all right?"
she asks me. The muted TV in the corner of the small flat is tuned to a news report, a helicopter filming the burning wreckage of Hoyle's bus. It looks like the fight is over. We have to move quickly. "I don't know," I tell her, not wanting to say that I doubt her Sepan survived. "We need to get moving, and I don't want to upset her. There's no time for grieving right now. Not only is she way younger than I expected, Maggie doesn't possess any of the bravado I thought came prepackaged with the guard after spending years in one's memories. She's fidgety and nervous, not cool and confident, and not at all ready to fight. So that makes two of us. I take in the rest of the apartment. It doesn't look lived in. Maggie probably moved in within the last week. A layer of dust still covers the empty mantel and countertops. There's a small suitcase open next to a half-deflated air mattress, with piles of clothes spilling out onto the floor around it, and a desk with a bowl of cereal on it, a couple of marshmallows still floating in the pink-tinted milk. I scan around the room, looking for the chest that we've been taught all the guard have, but I don't see it anywhere. Either she doesn't have it, or she's found a good place to hide it. Next to the cereal bowl is the laptop that brought me here. The computer is still open to the blog post. Scroll down to the bottom of the page where comments would go. The poor kid has just been sitting here waiting for someone to reply, and I'm the one who showed up. "You shouldn't have done that," I say, nodding to the laptop. Maggie looks guilty, rushing over to the laptop to shut it.
"I know. Conrad would be mad," she says, glancing over at the scene on TV. "I was just worried he wouldn't come back, and—"
Maggie stops herself, looking embarrassed. She doesn't have to finish. I know what she was going to say, that she was afraid she'd be alone. Fear, loneliness. It was a similar blend of feelings that caused one to take up with brain-dead surfers and start shoplifting. I don't really want to admit it, but they're the same feelings I've been having since waking up.
"What number are you?" she says.
"It doesn't matter now," I say. I think back to my course on legacy preparedness. Our instructors warned us about so many different powers the guard might possess, and I try to think of one that might be helpful now. "Is it too much to hope that you can teleport?"
"What?"
she asks, not understanding.
"Your legacies," I explain.
"Oh." She shakes her head.
"No. Conrad says I'm a couple years from developing those."
Maggie studies me as I walk across the room, kneeling down in front of her suitcase.
"Why?"
she asks.
"What can you do?"
I don't answer. Next to her suitcase is a small backpack that I unzip to find filled with books, novels by human authors who I've never heard of. I dump out the books and begin stuffing handfuls of Maggie's clothing into the backpack. We'll need to travel light. I don't pay attention to what I'm packing, only that it won't be enough to slow her down if we need to run.
"What are you doing?"
she asks, still rooted to the spot next to the laptop.
"Packing,"
I reply. "Grab only what you need. Definitely leave the computer." Maggie doesn't make any move to help. I can feel her watching me, trying to figure out what's happening.
"I want to wait for Conrad,"
she says, her voice small but firm. "He won't be coming," I reply, trying not to snap at her. She needs to start moving now,
I zip the backpack shut and stand. You have to trust me. Winston trusted Julia, and look how that turned out.
Winston? Julia? I try to remember what little I can of Lorik culture, thinking that this is some kind of Lorik saying I'm unfamiliar with. Or maybe there's some other members of the guard I should know, but I come up with nothing. I decide to guess.
I haven't seen them since we landed on Earth, I say.
They're from Earth, says Maggie. Also, they're not real.
I stare at her, confused.
1984,
says Maggie, seeing my confusion.
George Orwell?
One of the books from her backpack. I shake my head.
Never read it. Who did you think I was talking about? You aren't Lorik?
She says, examining my gaunt face, my pale skin.
No,
I reply.
And you aren't human either.
This sounds more like an accusation. When I shake my head, Maggie inches toward where she set down her little gun. I don't make any move to stop her. She's perceptive. I can see the wheels turning in her head, analyzing her situation. She knows there's trouble, but she's not sure if it's on its way or if it's already here.
If you're one of them, why haven't you tried to kill me yet?
She asks. She reminds me of myself a little bit, small, intelligent, and holding on to a belief that she can think her way out of problems.
I don't know what I am, I manage, realizing as I say this that it's the truth.
But I'm not here to hurt you. I toss her the backpack.
You need to run. It doesn't matter if it's with me or from me. Just run.
Suddenly, there's a sharp breaking sound, the apartment's front door splintering as it is torn off its hinges.
Too late. Too late to run.
Atomos!
Snarls Ivan as he strides into the room.
Fancy meeting you here.
Chapter 18. Streaming into the room behind Ivan are half a dozen Mogadorian warriors. Two of them stay posted at the door. The others fan out, covering the windows, cutting off any possible escape route. They're a well-oiled machine, the protocol in this situation clear. Contain the guard at all costs. I'm frozen in place. I'm not armed, having forgotten to grab so much as a dagger on my way out of the Mogadorian headquarters. Even if I did try to fight, against my own people, a concept I still haven't come to terms with, I wouldn't stand a chance. At least, that's how I justify my cowardice. Maggie doesn't suffer from any of my uncertainties. She might have given me the benefit of the doubt, but not Ivan and his strike team. She knows she's in danger. She executes a gymnast-caliber somersault towards the table where she set down her gun. Maggie moves more quickly than I expected, her fingers nearly closing around the weapon. But Ivan is quicker. Before Maggie can grab the gun, he boots the table towards her. The edge hits her right in the stomach, audibly knocking the wind out of her. Maggie, the gun, and the table all go crashing to the floor. Maggie recovers quickly, already desperately scrambling for the weapon when Ivan kicks it out of her reach. It skitters to a stop just inches from my feet. Ivan steps on the back of Maggie's neck, grinding her face into the dusty floor. He must outweigh her by more than 100 pounds. Maggie thrashes, screaming in frustration and pain, but Ivan keeps her pinned as he lifts up his shirt, examining his rib cage. At first, I don't understand what he's doing, but then I realize he's looking for bruises. If Maggie was still protected by the Lorik charm, then the damage from when Ivan kicked the table into her would have been done to him. Unless she's next in line. Ivan just confirmed that Maggie is number two.
Number two,
he says, a note of gruesome satisfaction in his voice.
My lucky day.
While Ivan has his shirt up, I notice a wound on his side. It looks like a bullet graze. Blood runs down his body, collecting in the waistband of his pants. He sees me looking and smiles proudly.
"Don't worry, buddy," Ivan says. "You should see the other guy."
He winks. That's when it hits me. Ivan doesn't know what I was doing here. All he cares about is that the protocol of his mission has just changed from apprehend to eliminate. Understanding that Ivan was referring to her Sipan, Maggie begins struggling with renewed vigor. She manages to slip from under Ivan's boot, but only gets a hard kick in the chest for her trouble. The way Ivan kicks Maggie is as casual as the way I watched my sister build and snuff out a piken. Maggie's down again, and this time Ivan presses a foot onto her back. She coughs raggedly, then cranes her neck up to look at me. One of the lenses of her glasses is shattered.
"You said you'd help me,"
she gasps. Ivan laughs. Some of the other Mogadorians in the room crack smiles.
"Is that what he told you?"
exclaims Ivan, amused.
"Crafty, Adamus. You always were the smart one. Come rushing over here all by yourself to claim all the glory, while the rest of us are out fighting."
Ivan waves his hand at the gun at my feet.
"Go ahead,"
he says.
"Help her."
Sarcasm drips from his words. I pick up the gun in a shaky hand and hold it loosely at my side. None of the Mogadorians in the room have weapons drawn. They really have no idea what I was doing here. Of course, they don't believe Number Two. Why would they trust her over one of their own? I glance around the room and force a smile. Ivan thinks he's just handed me a gift, and I know I need to play along. But what I'm really trying to figure out is how many I'd be able to kill before they returned fire. 2? Maybe 3? I'd start with Ivan, that much I'm sure of. The small gun feels impossibly heavy. It's now or never. But I can't do it. I can't kill my own people any more than I could kill Maggie. I meet her eyes, large and pleading. I wish I could at least tell her how sorry I am, but the words won't come. I'm too afraid to even speak. I drop the gun and look away.
"Don't have the stomach for it,"
sneers Ivan, unsheathing his dagger.
"Whatever. You did your part."
Ivan reaches down and grabs a handful of Maggie's hair, jerking her head back to expose her throat. I see a metallic glint around her neck, her pendant. A grin spreads across Ivan's face as he sees it too. He raises his dagger, and I can feel him staring at me. Does he think I'm a coward? Or worse, a traitor?
"For Mogadorian progress!"
Ivan shouts. Chapter 19. There are hundreds of pictures of the Irish countryside in Two's Photos folder. Even when it's rainy, the landscape is beautiful. Lush and green. Hills sprawling. Mist sometimes rolling in. I click through until I reach a set of pictures dedicated to a goat. A scrawny little mongrel with brown patches of fur appearing like mudstains on his otherwise white coat. The pet Number Two had to leave behind when she and Conrad fled Ireland. Here's a picture with her arms flung around the goat's neck. I wonder what the animal's name was. I glance at the drying bloodstain on the apartment's floor, as if for an answer. The other Mogadorians have left, some to celebrate, others to have their wounds treated from the battle with Conrad. I've been left alone here to go through Number Two's laptop. There won't be any memory download this time. Rummaging through Two's private files will be as close as I get to knowing her. There are a few pictures of Conrad in Two's albums. Most of the time, her Sipan smiles indulgently. But other times, the photographs are candid. Conrad reading a book next to a fire. Conrad chopping wood. I get the impression that they led a quiet life together, much less contentious than one and Hilda. Besides the pictures, there are a few documents on the laptop. Two never kept a proper journal, but she wrote plenty. There is a long list of books to read. There are frequently updated rankings of her favorite novels, and more specific lists like strong female characters and villains cooler than the heroes. I read through these lists, although I hardly understand any of the references. I make some mental notes of books that I'd like to read. I think maybe two would be happy that someone, even a Mogadorian, took some of her recommendations. And then I think of the horror in Two's eyes as Ivan brought his dagger down, how I stood by and did nothing. What am I thinking? That I'll somehow make good on that by reading every title on the books that inspired me list? How stupid and hollow. Anything interesting? My father stands in the doorway. He made it out of the Conrad Hoyle fight unscathed. No, I reply, closing Two's laptop. The truth is, I've already deleted the only interesting thing on Two's computer. A reply to her ill-advised blog post. I deleted the comment along with the original posting, although I'm sure the techs back at headquarters already flagged it. The general looms over me. Normally, we're supposed to snap to attention when he enters a room, but I can't work up the energy to go through the motions. I stay slouched in the chair, looking up at him.
Ivanek tells me that you couldn't kill the guard, he says, disappointment and rebuke mixing in his voice.
I could have killed her, I clarify. Any of us could have killed her. She was a child. My father's face darkens.
Your tone disagrees with me, boy.
Yeah, I snap, suddenly reminded of the way one argued with Hilda. I want to say more, but then I think better of it. After all, look what happened to one. Sorry, father, I say in as even a tone as I can muster. It won't happen again.
That child would have killed you if the tables were turned, my father says, and I can tell by the way the vein along his temple throbs that this effort to engage me in civilized conversation is requiring great self-control. She would see your entire people wiped out.
That's what we've been taught, what Citrakis Ra has told us. But Two knew what I was, and she wasn't going to shoot me. Also, nowhere on her laptop files was there a list of preferred genocide methods. Once again, my head starts to spin as everything I've been raised to believe is called into question. Father, I don't think that's true, I say quietly.
You doubt what I've taught you, boy? What we learn from the great book?
I look up at the general. Meeting his gaze takes some effort, his eyes burning with his barely contained temper. Yes, I whisper. My father punches me in the face. His fist is as heavy as a brick, even though I'm sure he pulled the punch somewhat, or I'd be unconscious instead of merely toppling backwards out of the chair, my bottom lip split open. I feel blood trickling down my chin, taste it on my tongue. I know the smart thing would be to curl up, to avoid any further punishment. But instead, I climb to my knees, chin raised, waiting for the next strike. It doesn't come. My father stands over me, his fists clenched, staring into my eyes. I feel a heat that I haven't felt before. Anger. Righteous anger. And that emotion must reach my eyes, because my father's initial look of disgust suddenly betrays something else. A look I'm unfamiliar with. It's respect. Not for my argument against killing Two. Certainly not for that. But for being willing to take another punch.
Finally,
growls the general,
You've got some blood on you.
I look down at my hands. They're pale, soft, and clean. I think of watching number two die. My hands should be covered in blood. And just like that, the anger leaks out of me and is replaced by something else, something worse. Hopelessness. I'm sorry for defying you, I say, keeping my eyes downcast. You're right, of course. I can feel the general watching me for a moment longer, as if considering what to do with me. Then, without another word, he stalks out of the apartment, heedlessly walking through the spot where Ivan let number two bleed out. I sink onto my hands and knees, feeling suddenly breathless. How long can I keep going like this, living among a people that I no longer understand? Chapter 20. Back at Ashwood Estates, they hold a banquet for Ivan. All these planned suburban developments come equipped with community halls for neighborhood parties. It's been 3 years since one was killed, and our community hall hasn't seen use since then. People from the neighborhood spend a weekend cleaning out the dust, moving in a large table, and preparing food. I wasn't awake for the last celebration. I wish I could sleep through this one. The general gives a speech describing Ivan's valor in the field. Then he pins a medal shaped like a Mogadorian sword to Ivan's chest. Ivan grinning stupidly as my neighbors rapturously applaud. There's no mention made of my early arrival at Two's safe house, nor does my father spend even a moment memorializing the warriors that didn't return home, gunned down by Conrad Hoyle in the streets of London. No time spent on the week. I slip out, leaving behind a half-finished dinner, and I return to my house, enjoying the quiet darkness of my room. With the withering looks my father's been giving me since London, I'm sure he's glad I left early. Without me there, he can pretend Ivan is his true-born son. They'll both love that. It's a pleasant, breezy night, but I close my window, wanting to seal out the noise from the banquet. I gaze through narrowed eyes at the lights from the community hall, my neighbors enjoying their biggest celebration since coming to Earth, thanks to the cold-blooded murder of an unarmed child. When I turn away from the window, one is standing in the middle of my room. It's the first time that she's appeared to me since London. Her look is cold and accusing, far worse than the disdainful stares I've been receiving from my father. "You watched her die," she says. I pushed my knuckles into my temples and squeeze my eyes shut, trying to will her away. When I open my eyes, one hasn't budged. "Whatever part of my brain you're hiding out in," I snarl, "go back there and leave me alone. You could have at least kicked the gun to her," she says, ignoring me, giving her a fighting chance. It's a scenario I've agonized over. Two's silly little gun lying at my feet, her only a short distance away. I've played out the possibilities in my head and managed to rationalize the fear I was feeling at the time as strategic self-preservation. There was no way Two was getting out of that room alive, whether I helped her or not. But knowing that doesn't make me feel any less a coward. "They still would have killed her," I say, voice shaking. "And then they would have killed me." "Which is what you're really worried about," replies One, rolling her eyes, "saving your own skin." "If I die, what happens to you?" I ask, my voice rising. I want One to understand. "I'm already dead, dummy." "Are you? Because it sure seems like you're here now, making me feel worse than I already do. I'm sorry I couldn't save Two, but—" I'm interrupted by a soft knock on my bedroom door. I was so distracted by One, I didn't even hear footsteps coming up the stairs. Without waiting for me to invite her, my mother slowly opens my door, looking concerned. I wonder how much of my conversation with my imaginary friend she overheard. "Who are you talking to?" she asks.
I shoot a surreptitious glance to where one was standing a moment ago. She's gone now, retreated back into my brain.
No one, I snap, sitting down on the foot of my bed. What do you want? I wanted to check on you, she says, and gently takes my chin in her hands. She examines the yellowing bruise on my jaw, the scabbed over spot on my bottom lip. He should not have done this. I was being insubordinate, I say, the token reply to one of the general's rebukes coming easily. My mother sits down on the bed next to me. I get the feeling that she wants to say more, but is having trouble finding the words. He told me what happened, she begins, hesitating. With you and the guard, child. He wanted to send you to West Virginia, but I talked him out of it. There's a mountain base in West Virginia where intensive training classes take place. I've heard the training is really endless hours of laboring in underground tunnels. For a trueborn like me to be sent there would be the equivalent of a human teenager being sent to military school. Thanks, I reply, not entirely sure why my mother is telling me this. She stands up and goes to my window, looking out at the lights of the banquet. Get back to your studies, she says quietly. Grow stronger, and the next time you have a chance to take down a guard, do it. My mother kneels in front of me, cupping my bruised face in her hands. She stares into my eyes, her look beseeching. I stare back at her in disappointment, sensing that there's something more she wants to say. Yes, mother, I reply. She opens her mouth to speak, but closes it without saying a word. Chapter 21. I am a model young Mogadorian. I am dedicated to my studies. My understanding of Ra's great book is lauded by my instructors, my dedication to Mogadorian progress unquestioned. I finish top of my class in advanced tactical planning. My final essay on how a Mogadorian guerrilla force could overwhelm a well-defended human city with a minimum of Mogadorian casualties, trumpeted as something my father might have written in his younger days. Your son makes me certain that our military will continue to flourish well into the next generation, I overhear one of my instructors tell the general. My father replies with only a grim nod. We have not spoken since London. It has been 2 years. I keep my other tactical plans to myself. Secreted away in my room, I scribble out a plan for how a human army with proper strategic intelligence could repel a Mogadorian force. When I'm satisfied with the plan, I burn the pages in the bathroom sink and rinse away the ash. Hand-to-hand combat is still not my strong suit. Ivan always chooses me as his partner for drills. Afterward, I'm always bruised and sore, and Ivan has barely broken a sweat. He is bigger and stronger than any of the other students, and when we spar, I see an emptiness in his eyes. It's the same dark look he gave me when standing over Number 2's body in London. It's like he thinks we're still in competition for the general's favor, even though I've long dropped out of that race. He's won, but he's too dense to realize it, still viewing me as a rival. When we train with blades, he accidentally cuts my arm, the wound requiring 3 sutures. I'll toughen you up yet, Adamus, he sneers, standing over me, blood squeezing through my fingers as I hold my arm. Make your father proud. Thank you, brother, I reply. What little free time I have, I spend in the capital. I don't bring Ivan along on these trips anymore, and I no longer waste time human-watching at the National Mall. I find a quiet bookstore where I entertain myself for hours, reading what titles I can remember from 2's favorite books lists. I begin with George Orwell. Why did I have to get stuck in the brain of the universe's most boring Mogadorian? Complains one during a weekend trip to the bookstore. She visits me often, sometimes more than once a day. In a way, She's sort of my only friend. She teases me, but I know she doesn't mind these quiet periods of reading something other than the great book. During my Mogadorian classes, I can feel her mind growing restless inside me. Sometimes she manifests, commenting on how heinously pale my instructors are, or when I'm sparring with Ivan, how the discovery of deodorant would be a great step in Mogadorian progress. I've learned not to acknowledge her in public, to limit our conversations to the night when everyone else is asleep. It's then that we plan. I lie in bed, thinking. One paces around the room, anxious and bored.
"We should escape tomorrow," she says. "We could tell the president that there are a bunch of gross aliens planning war right in his backyard."
"Not yet," I reply, shaking my head. "We'll know when the time is right."
"What if the time is never right?"
I've spent 2 years like that, acting the part, waiting for an opportunity to make a difference. Even with their vast resources, my people are slow in finding the other guard. There are successful operations from other cells. A mission in upstate New York yields a captive guard. More often, there are missions that never get off the ground because the target disappears, or the scout team does. I'm not sure how long the guard can keep this up. I hope they manage to get organized soon, but I worry that one is right, that I'm biding my time for an opportunity that will never come. And then, finally, word comes to us about Africa.
Chapter 22. For the first time in years, I'm invited into the general's briefing room.
"We have reliable intelligence that a member of the guard might be hiding in Kenya," says my father, handing out a printout of an article from a travel magazine. The article is a few months old, and considering its vague content, it is no wonder it took our techs so long to unearth it. In the article, while gushing about a small marketplace in Kenya, the writer describes a kid with a strange ankle branding that's unlike anything he's seen on other local tribespeople. The description bears a striking resemblance to the Lorik charm.
"Has this been confirmed?" I ask, getting in my question before Ivan has even finished dragging his finger along the article's middle sentences.
"Obtaining confirmation using normal methods has proven an obstacle.
We can't exactly blend in with this kind of community," I say, earning a sharp look of annoyance from my father, even though he knows I'm right.
"What's that mean?"
asks Ivan, slow on the uptake as usual. It is just the two of us being briefed by the general. Whatever my father has planned in Kenya, it will be the first time Ivan and I will be out on our own. We both know what a prestigious and dangerous mission this is. I'm a little surprised the general chose me for this assignment, for any assignment, really. Could it be that he doesn't worry about placing me in harm's way anymore? I decide now is a good time to play the apt pupil, to demonstrate my commitment to Mogadorian progress.
"Assuming they're in an African village environment," I explain to Ivan, keeping my words insultingly slow, "it would make slipping in a scout team extremely difficult. They'd know we weren't locals, and we'd risk tipping our hand to the Lorik prematurely. It's smart planning on the guard's part. Isn't that right, Father?"
"Yes," my father concedes. "That is correct."
"Why don't we just go wipe out this village?" asks Ivan. "Who cares about blending in?"
I snort. "How many incidents like London do you think we can have before the humans start asking questions?"
"So what if they ask questions?"
"You'd endanger the security of the entire war effort to massacre one village, then?"
"Adamus,"
says the general, his voice a menacing rumble,
"would you like to run this briefing?"
"No, sir," I reply. Ivan smirks.
"As for your question, Ivanik, subtlety is the correct course of action here."
I feel Ivan deflate a little next to me. Subtlety is not something I'm sure Ivan even knows the meaning of.
We have managed to secure you cover identities that will not unduly disturb the locals, continues my father. You two will infiltrate this village and determine whether there is indeed a guard presence. I will have a strike team mobilized in the jungle should you obtain confirmation.
My father gives me a long look, sizing me up. Then he turns to Ivan.
Ivanek, you will be in charge. You will report back to me directly.
Ivan nods eagerly.
Yes, sir. Of course.
The general turns back to me.
Adamus, he says, do not disappoint me.
No, sir, I reply. Chapter 23. Ivan watches the mosquito bite his forearm, shakily take flight, and then plummet dead onto the hut's wooden floor. Our blood is apparently poisonous to the insects, although that doesn't stop them from trying. Ivan glowers at the swollen bites, reddening his arms.
We should have just wiped this place out, he grumbles.
The three tanned Italian aid workers in the hut with us pretend not to have heard him. I don't know who they think we are, what story they were told to convince them to let us pose as fellow volunteers, but I can tell they're afraid. I imagine they all have relatives locked in a place like West Virginia, that their complicity is part of some screwed-up deal my people forced on them. I wish I could tell them they weren't in danger, that this would all be over soon. But that would be a lie. We arrived in the village yesterday, in a jeep driven by one of the sullen aid workers. The place is small, carved out of the encroaching jungle. It's comprised of huts around a single well and a modest outdoor marketplace. The village is on the road to Nairobi, so its marketplace attracts people from smaller nearby villages, here to trade with each other or sell goods to the tourists that pass by on buses twice a day. There is a small basketball court next to the hut the aid workers live in, built by their predecessors to help them connect with the locals. Children sprint across the flattened soil, tossing a ragged, dark brown basketball at the netless hoop. Ivan and I are the perfect choices to be posing as aid workers. We're the right age for it. Idealistic teenagers come to volunteer their time between high school and college. It's the kind of activity that would look great on a kid's college application. Of course, for Mogadorians, assisting the less fortunate would be viewed as a waste of time.
Humanitarian aid, spits one, appearing at my side. Your people have a sick sense of humor.
I shake my head. She's right, but I doubt the general realizes the grotesque irony of our cover. To my people, these aid workers and the villagers are mere tactical assets, pawns to help us smoke out the guard that might be hiding in the jungle. Today, the aid workers have circulated word that they have a new shipment of vaccine for the village youths, something to fight against malaria. One by one, the local children line up to grit their teeth and receive a shot. When the children stop by our tent, Ivan and I study them. Most of them arrive barefoot or in sandals, but the ones wearing sneakers or socks are ordered by Ivan to take off their shoes and socks. None of them finds this strange. Humans are too trusting. There are many kids the age of the one we're looking for, but none of them bears the Lorik scar. Every smooth ankle is a relief to me. One of the kids receiving his injection stares at Ivan, then says something in Swahili. The other children in line laugh.
What did he say?
I ask. The aid worker with the needle pauses, giving me a nervous look. Then, in shaky English, replies,
He says your friend looks like pale hippo.
Ivan takes a step towards the boy, but I stop him with a hand on his shoulder. The boy's right, I tell the aid worker. He does look like a hippo. I flash the boy a thumbs up, and the children laugh again.
This is a waste of time,
seethes Ivan, and he stomps into the hut's back room, where we've stored our equipment. I assume he's going to report to my father, No Lorik found yet. Kenyan children hurt my feelings. I step outside the hut, watching as the villagers go about a normal day. I can't help but indulge in a fantasy like I used to when observing Washington, D.C., about what kind of improvements could be made to this place. This time, it's not a fantasy of conquest. It's one of assistance. With the technological advancements the Mogadorians are capable of, we could vastly improve these people's lives.
Their lives would be most improved, says one, if you just left their planet the hell alone.
You're right, I whisper back, feeling stupid. On the basketball court, teams are beginning to form up. A boy, about 14 years old, sees me watching and waves. When I wave back, he jogs over and says something in what I think is Italian. I'm sorry, I say. I don't understand.
Ah,
says the boy, and I see the wheels turning as he tries to place my language.
English American?
I nod. The boy is fit, tall for his age. He is dark-skinned, yet a few shades lighter than many of the other villagers. A smattering of sun-born freckles across his cheeks and nose. He looks somehow exotic. He is wearing a tank top and mesh shorts, a pair of worn basketball high tops, and striped high socks. High socks. My stomach drops as I realize who he is. The guard.
Sorry,
he says in slow but perfect English. The other aid workers speak Italian. My English is a little rusty.
No,
I say, swallowing hard. It's very good. He steps forward to shake my hand.
I'm Hanu.
Adam.
Like the first man. That's good. But right now we need a 10th man for even teams.
He gestures over his shoulder at the other kids waiting on the basketball court.
You want to play?
What I want is to scream at Hanu to run. I glance over my shoulder, wondering where Ivan is. I can't make this too obvious, can't make a scene. If Ivan detects anything unusual, he'll radio in to my father right away. Hanu's only advantage right now is that my people don't know who he is. There's still a chance for him and whoever his sepan is to slip away undetected. I need to get him away from the aid worker's hut.
Sure,
I say, although I've never so much as touched a basketball.
I'll play.
We haven't gone 3 steps before Ivan is jogging to catch up to us. The only way to describe his grin is shit-eating.
Adam,
he says, talking to me while sizing up Hanu.
Who's your new friend?
Hanu, replies the guard, shaking Ivan's hand. I can tell by the way Hanu grimaces that Ivan's grip is vice-like.
Another American. Cool.
Everything about Hanu is easygoing, even the leisurely way he walks us over to the basketball court. He looks at home here, comfortable. Too comfortable. I wonder how long he's lived here, how often he's come to this court to shoot hoops. I think about the paranoid behavior of the other Sepans, the nomadic life that one was forced to endure, the shut-in existence of two. It seems like Hanu has had such a peaceful time on Earth that he's forgotten there's a war on. Some of the younger children beam at Hanu as he passes by. He pats them on their heads, smiling back, joking with them in Swahili. I wonder how many languages he knows.
Did you get vaccinated?
Ivan asks, blunt as ever.
I don't remember you coming by.
Hanu waves this away with a serene smile.
Me? I'm strong like an ox. Save that for the kids that really need it.
One of the other kids passes Hanu the ball, and he floats up a shot on a lazy arc. It drops through the basket without even brushing the rim.
Have you lived here long?
I venture.
All my life,
he replies. The kids pass the ball back to Hanu, and he flips it over to Ivan.
Take a shot, big man.
Ivan squeezes the ball so tightly that for a moment I'm afraid it will pop. Then he hurls it towards the basket in an ugly imitation of Hanu's stroke, the ball clanging wildly off the side of the backboard. Some of the kids, including the one who called Ivan a hippo, laugh.
"Good try,"
says Hanu cheerily, winking at the laughing kids. Ivan's expression darkens. I jump in, trying to direct the conversation in a way that will raise Hanu's dormant danger alarms without tipping off Ivan. "Is it weird to have strangers just showing up at your village?" I ask. Hanu shrugs.
"We get tourists on the bus sometimes,"
he glances over at Ivan.
"I hope you guys packed sunscreen. Your friend is turning red."
Ivan grabs my arm before I can form another awkward question.
"Come on, Adam. We have work to do."
Hanu looks disappointed as Ivan drags me away.
"Maybe we'll play later, yeah?"
"I hope so," I tell him. As soon as we're out of earshot, Ivan hisses to me.
"That was him."
He looks thrilled.
"You might be worthless in a fight, but you could sniff out a guard better than any of our scouts."
I glance over my shoulder. Hanu has already put us out of his mind, helping some of the younger kids practice their form. "We can't confirm that's him," I say.
"Oh, come on, Adamus," groans Ivan. "I should have choked him right out there."
"You don't want to waste the general's time until we can be sure," I say, trying to buy time.
"Plus, even if that is our guard, you don't know he's number 3.
Ivan sneers at me, and I can tell his mind is made up. When we get back into the hut, he grabs the nearest aid worker by the shirt and pulls him over to the window.
"That kid," he says, pointing at Hanu. "Where does he live?"
The aid worker hesitates, but I can see the fear in his eyes.
"Not sure,"
he mumbles.
"Outside the village, I think, near the ravine."
"Good enough,"
says Ivan, shoving the aid worker away. He glances at me before disappearing into the back room.
"I'll tell Father you say hi."
So that's it. Soon the strike team will be here. I return to the doorway, watching Hanu dribble past a defender and flip a layup into the basket.
"He's dense,"
observes one, suddenly standing next to me, looking at Hanu.
"You have to tell him."
I nod. No more waiting around, no more planning, no more subtlety. There will never be a more perfect opportunity to defect. I've already watched one Lorik die because of my uncertainty, because I failed to act in time. I won't let this one be captured, or worse.
"You're right," I whisper back. "Tonight, we escape."
Chapter 24. Night has fallen. The jungle around me is alive with strange noises. I should be worried about what kinds of animals are out there, snapping branches as they stalk me, hissing around my ankles. But there are other, more dangerous predators in the jungle tonight, ones that I need to stop. I run through the jungle with only a vague idea of where I'm going. Maybe running isn't exactly accurate, more like stumbling. It seems like every vine on the jungle floor has a mind to trip me. It's so dark out here, I'm practically blind. My knees and elbows are scraped from falls, my face cut from the branches slapping against it. Still, I press on toward the ravine. The communicator on my hip buzzes with static. I swiped it before sneaking out of the aid worker hut. My plan is simple. The best I can do under such circumstances. Get to Hanu and his Sipan. Tell them what's happening and use the communicator to monitor my people's movements. Hopefully, with Hanu's knowledge of the jungle, we'll be able to stay one step ahead of the soon-to-be-arriving strike team. It won't be easy. Because of the remote location, my father has authorized a larger unit than normal, including a piken. But I know how my people think, how they attack. I can do this. All I have to do is get to Hanu first. A task this thick jungle isn't making very easy. When the jungle begins to thin out before me, moonlight shining through the canopy overhead, I know that I'm close. I can hear rushing water in the distance, the river coursing through the nearby ravine. And then I see it. A single, solidly built hut. The jungle around it has been painstakingly cleared, leaving a flat expanse that's littered with angular mahogany equipment. As my eyes adjust, I realize the objects are some kind of homemade obstacle course. So Hanu does more training than just pick up basketball games in the village. That's good. He'll need to be agile for what's to come. I approach the hut cautiously. The last thing I need is to spook Hanu and his Sepan. If he's anything like Conrad Hoyle, Hanu's Sepan might emerge from that hut with guns blazing. I stop, stiffening, the hair on the back of my neck rising. Footsteps are crashing through the jungle behind me. I break out in a cold sweat, despite the African heat. I turn to see Ivan emerging from the jungle. In the moonlight, I see a trickle of sweat roll down his cheek, his face contorted in a humorless smile.
"Clever, Adamus," he sneers. "Thought you'd get away with this."
He's on to me.
"With what?"
I ask, stalling. I glance over my shoulder at the hut. There's no movement inside. The sounds Ivan and I are making drowned out by the jungle. I'll stop Ivan if I have to, but I hope it won't come to that. Maybe I can still talk my way out of this. I walk backwards toward the edge of the clearing, standing inches away from Ivan.
"Get out of here, Ivan,"
I say, trying to sound as intimidating as possible. He snorts, disbelieving.
"What? And let you try to steal all the glory? You'll probably freeze up again."
And then I realize what dim-witted Ivan thinks I'm doing out here. He doesn't think I've come to warn Hanu. Such treason isn't even a possibility to him. Ivan thinks I've come to capture or kill Hanu myself, just like he assumed I did with number two.
"You didn't even bring any weapons,"
Ivan observes mockingly.
"Are you going to talk the Lorik to death?"
He's right. I came unarmed, hoping it would help convince Hanu to trust me. Also, I never intended to actually fight my people, only evade them. I hoped that violence could be avoided. With speed that surprises Ivan, I snake my hand forward and rip the dagger off his belt. His jaw drops when I hurl the weapon into the jungle.
"Adamus!"
he exclaims, sounding hurt, like a kid who's had his favorite toy broken.
"What the hell? You better help me look for that!"
I grab Ivan by the front of his shirt and put my face to his. He's surprised again, not used to being manhandled. I stare into his eyes, trying to reach him. I know it's crazy, but Ivan used to be my best friend, despite everything. I have to believe that he'll still listen to me.
"Why do this?"
I ask. "Killing them won't heal our planet. It won't lead to Mogadorian progress. It'll only lead to more killing. More life wasted. Is that what you want?"
"What the hell are you talking about, Adamus?"
He stares at me, dumbfounded. I shake him.
"We don't always get along," I continue. "But you're like a brother to me. You trust me, don't you?"
Mutely, Ivan nods his head.
"Then trust me when I tell you that everything we've been told is wrong," I say desperately. "Our cause is unjust, Ivan. We can change that. You can help me work toward real Mogadorian progress."
I can see him trying to make sense of my words, confusion on his face. He looks away from me, over my shoulder, to the hut where Hanu and his Sepan sleep. For a moment, I allow myself to think that I've gotten through to him. Then he shoves me away. He's finally realized what I'm up to, and it disgusts him.
I always knew you were weak, Adamus,
hisses Ivan, but not a traitor, too. That settles it. I unclip the communicator from my belt and slam it into the side of Ivan's face. Chapter 25. I had hoped the blow would knock Ivan out. I should have known better. Ivan is back on his feet before I can create some distance between us. He doesn't even register the trickle of blood from the cut I made above his eyebrow. That dead look I've seen in his eyes during a dozen training sessions comes on, and he's barreling towards me. Ivan drives his shoulder into my stomach and lifts me, hurling me into a tree. The air explodes out of my lungs in a wet cough. Ivan grabs a handful of my hair and slams my head into the tree. Stars flash across my vision. I struggle to stay conscious. Desperately, I kick at Ivan, my shin connecting solidly with his groin. He doubles over, retching, and drops me. I stumble backward into the jungle, shaking the cobwebs out of my head. Ivan is on me again before I have a chance to regroup, delivering a two-punch combination to my chest, followed by an uppercut that sends me tumbling over a fallen tree trunk. I scuttle backwards on my hands, running my tongue over the gap where my tooth used to be.
"You can do better than that,"
says one, sitting cross-legged on the tree trunk.
"Shut up,"
I mutter. Ivan leaps onto the tree trunk, standing above me. He points over his shoulder, a wild look in his eyes.
"You want to fight me for them?"
he snarls.
"For some Lorik trash? You're choosing them over us?"
"Yes."
"Then you can die with them!"
Ivan jumps off the log, intending to stomp my face. I roll away at the last moment, kicking him in the side of the knee as he lands. I hear something snap inside Ivan's leg, and he howls with pain. I scramble to my feet, center myself, regain my balance. Ivan lunges towards me, now limping slightly, but this time I'm ready for him. I deflect his punches, all straight ahead, angrily telegraphed, using his own momentum and speed against him. It's something I never tried in our sparring sessions, but it's exactly what Hilda had been teaching Number One. Ivan comes at me again, frustrated. His blow is more furious than ever. I duck under them, and when he's off balance, drive the heel of my hand into his nose. His feet go out from under him. I step down on Ivan's throat, thinking of Number Two and the way he stepped on her neck. Out of the corner of my eye, I think I see a flicker of light coming from the direction of Hanu's hut. But maybe it's just my imagination.
"Not so easy when someone hits back, huh?"
I say. Ivan shoves my foot away, but I catch his wrist in both of my hands. He pulls me to the ground and tries to climb on top of me. He punches wildly at me with his free hand, but I'm in control. I whip my legs up and slip one leg under his chin, the other behind his head, then pull down on his head with both of my hands, choking him. It takes a full minute for Ivan to lose consciousness, punching me in the ribs the whole time with decreasing force. When it's over, I shove his body away, lying on my back. I'm hurting all over, but I'm alive. Around me, the jungle has grown eerily quiet. But then I hear the hiss of orders broadcast across the half-broken communicator discarded in the dirt a few feet away. And I know what's coming. I'm too late. Chapter 26. I manage to get to my feet and stagger towards the hut. I notice shadows lurking in the jungle around me, the scouts maintaining a perimeter. In the hut's doorway, the crumpled body of a 50-year-old man bleeds from a vicious sword wound. Hanu's Saipan. Dead, like the other Saipans. Which means they must have discovered the boy is Number Three. I feel like sinking to my knees like giving up. I've thrown my entire life away tonight. I can never go home again. They'll know me as a traitor. I'll be spending the rest of my life running and hiding, hunted, just like the guard. And for what? I didn't even manage to help Hanu. I was too late. Took too long fighting with Ivan. I've accomplished nothing. Suddenly, the back wall of the hut explodes outward, splinters cascading in all directions. There is Hanu, alive, running, and running fast. Faster than humanly possible. He takes off before my people have a chance to close in, speeding towards the ravine. There's still a chance. There's no way that I can keep up with Hanu, but I run as fast as my body will allow, breath whistling painfully through my lungs. There are other pursuers nearby. I can hear them crashing through the jungle. Even with all the other scents in the jungle, I can still smell the acidic tang of pikin breath as one charges towards the ravine. If I can only find a way to get to Hanu first, maybe I can still help him. The sound of rushing water grows louder. I don't know how Hanu plans to cross the ravine. Maybe he's strong enough to jump it. Maybe he knows some secret way down. It doesn't matter, as long as he gets away. If he does, there is hope. I see Hanu's silhouette nearing the edge of the ravine, maybe 30 yards from where I'm standing. There is a piken close on his heels. I'm afraid for him. He doesn't have anywhere to go. But when Hanu reaches the edge of the ravine, he jumps, landing safely on the other side. It's a jump I could never make, and neither can the piken. He's safe. Except my father is waiting for him on the other side of the ravine. There is nothing more Hanu can do. The general grabs the boy and lifts him easily. He cuts a striking image, like a Mogadorian hero culled right from the great book. He hesitates for a moment, observing his prize, then tears what I know is the pendant from Hanu's neck and stuffs it into his cloak. There's no way across the ravine. I can only watch as my father laughs, then pulls his sword from its scabbard. Its glowing shaft pierces the night before he plunges it through Hanu's chest, and then drops him callously to the ground. He's dead. One is screaming inside my head. Or is that me? The general stares across the ravine. For a moment, our eyes lock. I hear haggard footsteps approaching me from behind. I know what they mean, but I don't turn to face them. My brief rebellion is at an end. Goodbye, Adamus, hisses Ivan as he slams both his hands into my back, shoving me over the edge of the ravine, towards the rocks and water below. Chapter 27. The sun is warm on my face, in wonderful contrast to the cool saltiness of the ocean breeze. I relax back on my elbows and close my eyes. I turn my face up towards the sun, soaking in the California rays. When I open my eyes, one is sitting on the sand next to me. She is so beautiful. Her blonde hair is loose, brushing lightly across her bare shoulders. This is wonderful. Such a pleasant sensation. I can't ever remember feeling so content. Why does she look so stricken? Adam, she says, you have to wake up. Wake up from what? I ask, feeling not a care in the world. I reach out and take her hand. One doesn't pull away. She just stares into my eyes with a pleading look. You have to wake up, she repeats. I feel a sudden chill. Somehow, my body is in two places at once. The other place is wet and cold, painful. My body is tossed across rocks, buffeted endlessly by a forceful current. I can feel that some of my bones are broken, sharp pains slicing up and down my body. I push that reality aside. I try to focus on California.
Please, wake up!
One pleads. But it's so nice here.
If you stay here, you'll die.
When I open my mouth to respond, muddy river water spills out. I gasp for breath, choking, struggling. The current is strong, pulling me downward. But that doesn't make sense. I'm on a beach in California. All the pain is somewhere else, happening to someone else. One looks so sad and desperate. I have to turn away. The sun is just beginning to set over the ocean, the sky turning orange and purple. Soon, it will be dark, and I'll be able to rest.
Wake up and fight!
Begs one.
Please, Adam!
I don't know if I can.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged recording of I Am Number 4, The Lost Files, The Legacies, by Pittacus Lore. Performed by Devin Sorvery, Jeff Brick, and Kaleo Griffith. This program was produced and directed by Bob Dion. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. The Fallen Legacies text copyright 2012 by Pittacus Lore. Nine's Legacy text copyright 2012 by Pittacus Lore. Six's Legacy text copyright 2011 by Pittacus Lore. Production copyright 2012 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.